that is true, Lord. Thank you for that help. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. So we're going to continue with Chronicles today, and we're going to take a big chunk of chapters today. We're going to go basically Chronicles 21 to 27. That's what we're doing today. Before we start in 21, I'm just going to review with you now. There's a 20-year gap between where we left off at last chapter and the start of this chapter. And I'm going to review with you the area that we're talking about. So this is the time of the judges, which is the time before David became king. And this is the geopolitical situation in the area in which Yahweh Tzvaot led David into all of his victorious battles. So he conquered the local area here, all the nations around Israel. And the Egyptians, remember, were devastated by the plagues when Israel came out. And that's the beginning of the Judges period of several hundred years. And then David is the end of that Judges period of several hundred years. And it's no surprise that the Egyptians took hundreds of years to recover from the massive damage done to their country and their economy by the plagues, the loss of slave labor, the whole deal. So this control of the Holy Land by the Egyptian Empire at this time was very, very loose during the Judges period. And you get that sense when you read through Judges that it was pretty much the Wild West. So this is the situation. And so we can see we've got the Hittite Empire is the most powerful at the time that David becomes king. And Assyria is just getting started. And of course, they will eventually dominate the entire Middle East. And we have the Babylonians down here. And then Elam over in Iran. And this was a more detailed description, a close-up of our area here. And so we could see this is the Philistines. And then we've got Aram, and we got Ammon, Moab, Edom. That's how things lined up there. And then here's Jerusalem. And in what we read yesterday, we read that David's military conquests extended all the way out to the Euphrates River. So now he didn't control this area out here, but he went as far as here with some of his military expeditions. He did control, though, all of these neighbor territories by the time his kingdom was probably midway through his kingdom. And so we have tribute and slave labor and various other forms of payment being made by the conquered peoples to David's kingdom. The setup for the vast wealth and power of Solomon, his son, his kingdom. So this is the blessing of God for David's obedience. Now there's a 20-year gap we talked about between the last chapter and this one, 21. And so during that time, obviously we talked about Bathsheba, and hopefully you guys read that very interesting and, you know, profound story in multiple different ways. Also, we have the much longer account in 2 Samuel of Absalom's attempted revolution, David's son, Absalom, rebelling against him. And that goes on for, I don't know, I think it's 5 or 6 chapters in Samuel. It's a really important event. Eventually put down by David. But if you remember, David had to flee Jerusalem with a small cadre of close, you know, people. He left some of his wives there at the palace. He took some with him, but it was a scary time. He had to flee to the east across the Jordan River. And then there was a smaller rebellion among some of the Benjaminites led by Sheva, and that was also put down. So this is what's happening in this 20 years. Now, 1 Chronicles 21, we'll get started here. We have a kind of a bookend situation here where we've got verses 1 through 3, and then at the end, kind of this bookend section, 27, 24, is Joab, the son of Zeruiah, began to take a census, but did not finish. And wrath came on Israel for this. The number was not put into the account in the Chronicles of King David. So that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about this episode of the census. But first in 21:1, we'll talk about a little interesting thing here. It starts out, Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. So this is interesting because the word here, the Hebrew word, is hasatan. And in the red, you can see the he is the. So without the he, it's satan. With the he, it's the satan. And satan is a Hebrew word that means the adversary, means adversary. It's actually used in the Old Testament multiple times, I forget how many, 20 to 30 times. Most of those times, it is not referring to the head adversary, the evil, you know, head of the evil spirits, Satan. It's not referring to him. It's just referring to an adversary in general or some other adversary in the story. So, Satan is a Hebrew word that just means adversary. Here is the only place in the entire Old Testament where the he is not present. So it's not the adversary. It's just Satan. So most of your English translations will actually put that as a name with a capital S, Satan, and use it. But everywhere else in the Old Testament, it's Hasatan, the adversary. So it's likely, I think, certainly possible that there's a minor scribal error here, as will sometimes happen here and there. None of them make any important difference in the meaning, but here it's very possible that Hasatan was in the original manuscript, and that because of a scribal error, it's come down to us in history without the hay. So if that was the case, it would be consistent with every other use of the word in the Old Testament. And therefore, we just have, in that case, the adversary again and not a name. Now, it's interesting that the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, doesn't use this word as a name, but rather as a title or description, kind of like the adversary. The word is diabolos in Greek, and it's where we get our English word diabolical. And it has the same meaning as the adversary. Here in the Septuagint at this verse, it uses diabolos just as it does in every other use of Satan in the Old Testament. So the Septuagint would sort of agree with my suspicion that this was meant to be the adversary and not a name. Now, where do we get to, though, this being a name? Well, that's in the New Testament, where it's used more like we would see a name used. But again, in the New Testament, we've got in Revelation 12:9. The great dragon was thrown down, the old serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his messengers were thrown down with him. So here we have two Greek words. The devil there translated is diabolos. And then we have satana. But this Greek word satana is not a Greek word. It's just a transliterated word into the Greek language that matches the Aramaic Hebrew word. So Satan in Hebrew, and in Aramaic it's satana. And so what the Greeks did is they just took that Aramaic word satana and wrote it in Greek. Okay, so Revelation gives us both and says it's the same person, diabolos and satana. In Matthew 4:10, Jesus is speaking directly with the devil. Matthew 4:10. Then Yeshua said to him, "Go, Satan, for it is written, you shall bow down to Yahweh your Elohim and serve him only." So there it's satana. But again, is this being used by Jesus as a name, or is he using it in the sense, the Hebrew sense, that go adversary, or go away from me adversary? The chief adversary, to be sure. But the question here is, does this adversary of David and Yeshua and us every day, does this adversary actually have a personal name? I'm not so sure he does. If he does, we don't know it. So it may not be Satan. So something interesting to think about. Do we know the personal name of our God? Yes, we do. He has revealed it to us. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yahweh. And we know the personal name of our Savior, our Messiah. Yes, we do. Yeshua, in his language, and then we call him Jesus in ours. Do we need to know if there was a personal name? And if there was, do we even need to know it of our chief adversary? I don't think so. I don't care to know it. I know that Yahweh is in control, like I said, of that spiritual realm, and every interaction of that spiritual realm with our material universe is under Yahweh's control. So there's no reason to fear. There's no reason to have any kind of personal interaction at all with our chief adversary, in my mind. In fact, I think that that's probably one of the biggest markers of a, as my son would say, a sus situation. If you're talking to other believers who are really into whatever, casting demons out and, you know, addressing Satan in prayer in any kind of way, for me, it seems a little sus. Right? If we are confronted with the demonic, we need to pray as Jesus taught us to pray to our Father in heaven, asking for his help in that situation. So, anybody have any comments or? Go ahead. That's actually a super excellent question. I don't even know why I didn't think of that. You know, I'm going to have to go. I could look it up really quick right now, but I'll move on. But I'll look that up and I'll bring it back next week. So I don't know where Lucifer comes from with that name. So that's a great question.
2 Samuel 24:1 says, "Again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he and
Yes. Yes, yes, it is. It is. So every interaction of the spiritual realm with our material universe in which we exist is under Yahweh's control. So it says here that in Chronicles, let's go back to where are we starting, Chronicles 21, that the adversary stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. Was that interaction with David's mind, which exists in our material universe, just like our minds do, was that spiritual interaction with his mind allowed by God? Did God know it was going to happen, and did he let it happen? Yes, Yahweh did. So in that sense, is this something that Yahweh has done, or is this something that Satan has done? Right, yeah. Yeah, yeah, and we have, right, and we have a fairly detailed story that illustrates this in Job, this interaction of Satan and Yahweh in the spiritual realm, and what goes on there, you know, in deliberation on how they're going to interact in the physical realm in which we live. I don't know that every single interaction there's deliberation, but, you know, who knows? So, that's a good question, though. Any other questions? There are multiple other relatively minor places where there is disagreement, apparent disagreement between what Chronicles says and what Samuel says about the same events. Another example is what we're going to get to here in verses 11 and 12. I'll briefly explain that. But let's go on. So the adversary stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. David said to Joab and to the princes of the people, "Go count Israel from Beersheba even to Dan, and bring me word that I may know how many there are." So that's from the very, very south to the very, very north, entire country. Joab said, "May Yahweh make his people 100 times as many as they are. But my master, the king, are they not all my master's servants? Why does my master require this thing? Why will he be a cause of guilt to Israel?" So, some words of wisdom from Joab and another great Bible character who was not perfect, certainly not, but had his moments of trusting Yahweh, and this was one of those. You know, he was a relative and David's closest government, you know, leader as the leader of the army, in a position of amazing trust and access, and yet there's still some risk, right? And you have a king with unlimited power, you know, to say something like that. So he was taking some risk, and he's trusting God when he's doing this. Good advice. Nevertheless, verse 4, the king's word prevailed against Joab. Therefore Joab departed and went throughout all Israel and then came to Jerusalem. Joab gave up the sum of the census of the people to David. All those of Israel were 1,100,000 men who drew the sword. And in Yehuda were 470,000 men who drew a sword. But he did not count Levi and Benjamin among them, for the king's word was abominable to Joab. So there's this little little personal rebellion going on there. So, and it's interesting. It's interesting just to think about that. Why would it be the Levites and the Benjaminites that he wouldn't count? Hard to say. It's easy in the case of the Levites. You know, they were set apart to service to God, to the temple, and to the worship of God. But some of the Levites' job was in guarding the temple, and at least those Levites would be quite skilled in the in battle. And then the Benjaminites, at least some of them, were quite famous for their skill in battle. So just it's possible that we'll see in the story that the punishment approaches Jerusalem and ends there, doesn't affect the city, but is so very close. And that area is very close to Benjamin as well. So it might be that this census started and hadn't got to Benjamin yet before it was prematurely ended. Yep. Right. But this was a separate census. Yeah. And so what was the purpose of that? What was going on in David's mind? What was this temptation that Satan had put into his mind? What do you think is the motivation here? Yeah, it said over 1 million men who drew the sword. So, you know, that implies that it was a primary military purpose. What other purposes are there in a census? Know where everybody is. Yeah, that's true. But why would you want to know that? So you can send the tax man. That's one reason. So if it was a primary military purpose, I showed you a picture. David's conquered all of the local enemies. They're all paying tribute. They're all serving him now. I mean, yeah, you've got these other civilizations out there. You got the Hittite Empire way up in the north and Turkey. Right? But why? Yeah. Right. But what would be the military purpose of doing this count at this time? Remember, 20 years has passed. There doesn't seem to be any rebellion happening. He's been extremely successful. What do you think is going on in his head? Well, he's certainly in that mindset. We'll see later. He helps his young son, Solomon, prepare for the building of the temple. It just is amazing how much preparation he put into that. Solomon stepped into like the best situation anybody could have. So, yeah, Kelly?
He might be having a
look at what I did. Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, let's put a plaque on the wall that says how many million people we got in the country. Yeah, that sort of thing. You know what I think it was? Possibly. I think that David might have been thinking about empire building. Right? I showed you that little bit of the Assyrian Empire that's just getting started up there around Nineveh, right? What did the Assyrians do? They just kept going. And what did the Babylonians do? They just kept going. And what did the Persians do? And what did the Greeks do? And the Romans? That's the nature of man. You're militarily successful, and you just keep going. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's probably the best argument for us being involved over there. Is Putin going to just be fine with Ukraine if he takes it? Where's he going to keep going? Anyway, so as we'll see, sorry, I was going to actually, last night I was going to put in really cool pictures in each one of those spots for famine, military defeats, and pestilence. But anyway, it got too late. I forgot. Go back and do that. So let's go ahead and keep reading. Elohim, verse 7, was displeased with this thing. Therefore he struck Israel. David said to Elohim, I have sinned greatly in that I have done this thing. But now put away, I beg you, the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. The Bible doesn't say what it was that God struck him or Israel with at this point. Yahweh spoke to Gad, David's seer, prophet, saying, go and speak to David, saying, Yahweh says, I offer you three things. Choose one of them that I may do it to you. So Gad came to David and said to him, Yahweh says, take your choice. Either 3 years of famine, three new moons to be consumed before your foes, while the sword of your enemies overtakes you, or else 3 days the sword of Yahweh, even pestilence in the land, and the messenger of Yahweh destroying throughout all the borders of Israel. Now therefore consider what answer I shall return to him who sent me. So this is Gad giving good advice. Think about this very carefully. And I think the implication here is there isn't any other options. This is you're going to get one of these punishments. And so think very carefully. But God's giving you a choice. That's a very interesting passage. And all kinds of implications here. All right. So, in verse 13, David said to Gad, I am in distress. Let me fall, I pray, into the hand of Yahweh, for his compassion is very great. Do not let me fall into man's hand. So that was how David thought it through. Who knows how long it took him. It might have taken him 5 minutes. But he chooses the shorter of the three punishments, the one that will last 3 days, and the one that will be supernaturally directed by God and not involve the brutality of other human beings. And so it's interesting here because, you know, David, I think, is wise and has a close relationship with Yahweh. He understands the ways of the world, the way that Yahweh works in the world. And there is something about men's free will here that David is really fearful of. You know, how brutal is this going to get if it's a military situation? So he opts instead for something totally in Yahweh's control, and that is pestilence. And a supernatural one at that, as we'll read. So Yahweh, verse 14, sent a pestilence on Israel, and 70,000 men of Israel fell. Of course, there were women and children as well, most likely. Elohim sent a messenger to Jerusalem to destroy it. As he was about to destroy, Yahweh saw and he relented of the disaster and said to the destroying messenger, an angel, in other words. Yahweh said to the destroying messenger, it is enough. Now withdraw your hand. The messenger of Yahweh was standing by the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite. David lifted up his eyes and saw the messenger of Yahweh standing between earth and the heavens, having drawn sword in his hand stretched out over Jerusalem. Then David and the elders, clothed in sackcloth, fell on their faces. David said to Elohim, is it not I who commanded the people to be counted? Is it even I who have sinned and done very wickedly? But these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand, O Yahweh, my Elohim, be against me and against my father's house, but not against your people, that they should be plagued. Then the messenger of Yahweh commanded Gad to tell David that David should go up and raise an altar to Yahweh on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. David went up at the saying of Gad, which he spoke in the name of Yahweh. All right, so this threshing floor is on Mount Moriah, and the way that wheat was processed, you wanted a windy spot without any breaks, so the wind would come through and blow away the chaff. It's thought, and very reasonable, that this exact spot is the very top of Mount Moriah, the very flat stone surface on which now the Dome of the Rock is built, and also thought to be the exact spot where Abraham attempted to sacrifice Isaac, and is also the exact spot where the temple, the first temple of Solomon, was built. This is just north of David's Jerusalem, outside the northern wall, and it's interesting that it makes a point here that Ornan, which is a Hebrew name, was not an Israelite ethnically. He was a Jebusite. So he was of the Canaanite population that originally populated Jerusalem, the Jerusalem David conquered. But the name change and the proximity and Ornan's behavior here, as we'll read, all indicates that he was a convert to following Yahweh. And again, a reminder that the Old Testament teaches us and the Torah teaches us that being one of God's chosen is not based entirely on ethnicity, but it is a state of the heart. And with that heart comes action. A heart that is for Yahweh and actions that follow Yahweh's Torah indicate that you are a part of that people, that chosen people. So here we have another example of that. Verse 20, Ornan turned back and saw the messenger, and his four sons were with him, hid themselves. Now Ornan was threshing wheat. As David came to Ornan, Ornan looked and saw David and went out of the threshing floor and bowed himself to David with his face to the ground. Then David said to Ornan, "Give me the place of this threshing floor that I may build an altar to Yahweh on it. You shall sell it to me for the full price, that the plague may be stopped from afflicting the people." Ornan said to David, "Take it for yourself and let my master the king do that which is good in his eyes. Behold, I give the oxen for ascension offerings, and the threshing instruments for wood, and the wheat for meal offering. I give it all." King David said to Ornan, "No, but I will most certainly buy it for the full price, for I will not take that which is yours for Yahweh, nor offer an ascension offering that costs me nothing." So David gave to Ornan 600 shekels of gold by weight for the place. David built an altar to Yahweh there, and offered ascension offerings and peace offerings, and called on Yahweh, and he answered him from the heavens by fire on the altar of ascension offering. So that's God's direct confirmation that what David's doing is obeying him, following his instructions, and God is blessing that effort. Remember we talked, last week or the week before about the difference between ascension offerings and peace offerings and why perhaps they would both be mentioned here. There's one very key difference between the two. So the ascension offerings are the olah, and the peace offerings are the zevach shalamim. So what was the difference? Someone's got to remember this. Lord, please.
The peace offerings were made or offered and consumed and eaten and shared.
Yes.
The burnt offerings were just burnt.
Yes, completely burnt. The olah is completely burnt and given to God. and the peace offerings, or another good name for the peace offerings, are the shared offerings. Only a portion of it is burnt and given to God. A portion of it is given to the priests. And a portion of it is eaten by the offerer, the person making the offering. So in this case, now we say that David, the writer Ezra, writing Chronicles, is making the point that David offered ascension offerings and peace offerings. So who is he sharing the peace offering with? Remember, at this time, there's something else on Mount Moriah. What other important thing is here on Mount Moriah? Nope, exactly. The Ark of the Covenant is in a tent here on Mount Moriah. And so we have priests to do the offering. And David's going to share some of that meat with the priests. But then I think that he probably shares it also with Ornan and his family. That would be right to do in this situation, because this is being offered by Ornan and his family. David's paying for it, but it's coming from Ornan as well. It's a sign of his trust. And so he and his family is going to participate in this offering as well. Verse 27, then Yahweh commanded the messenger, and he put his sword back into its sheath. At that time, when David saw that Yahweh had answered him in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, then he slaughtered there. For the tabernacle, and here's a little side description now of what we're talking about here. Okay, so we have the tabernacle in Gibeon, and we have the Ark of the Covenant in a separate tent on Mount Moriah. Verse 29, for the tabernacle of Yahweh, which Moshe made in the wilderness, and the altar of ascension offering, which is at the tabernacle, were at that time in the high place at Gibeon. But David could not go before it to inquire of Elohim, for he was afraid because of the sword of the messenger of Yahweh. Now chapter 21, verse 1, then David said, this is the house of Yahweh Elohim, and this is the altar of ascension offering for Israel. So God authorizes now a special exception to his general rule in the Torah, but he's making a special exception here, Yahweh, that this now will be a place of ascension offering to me. And this place of two places where ascension offerings can be made will very soon in the life of Solomon be combined again into one, when the temple, the first temple, is built on this site. And so this new altar for ascension offering will be the altar going forward when the temple is built. All right. Chapter 22, verse 2. David gave orders to gather together the sojourners who were in the land of Israel, and he sent masons to cut dressed stones to build the house of Elohim. Verse 3, he prepared iron in abundance. And verse 4, cedar trees. And he's gathering all this together for the building of the temple. And you could see why this might now be just, he's really pumped, he's excited about this now, right? Because now Yahweh has said, this is my altar now. So it's just again a reminder to David that God wants a temple built, and I'm going to get to participate in its building. Very excited. Verse 5, David said, Shlomo, my son, is young and tender, and the house that is to be built for Yahweh must be exceedingly magnificent of fame and of glory throughout all countries. I will therefore make preparation for it. So David prepared abundantly before his death. So the Hebrew name for Solomon is Shlomo, and it comes from the root word shalom. David was a man of war. This is the reason why God said he didn't want him to build the temple. Much bloodshed. Shlomo, a man of peace. Shalom, Shlomo. See, that's similar. It's from the same word. And Shlomo means peace. Verse 7, David said to Shlomo his son, "As for me, it was in my heart to build a house to the name of Yahweh, my Elohim. But the word of Yahweh came to me, saying..." All right, so now this is David telling Shlomo what God told him. This is David's understanding of what God told him. "You have shed blood abundantly and have made great wars. You shall not build a house to my name, because you have shed much blood on the earth in my sight. Behold, a son shall be born to you who shall be a man of peace. I will give him rest from all his enemies all around, for his name shall be Shlomo, and I will give peace and quietness to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, and he will be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever." And remember, we talked about that last week. We talked about there's a dual meaning here about the house and about Yahweh being David's son's father and about that kingdom that will last forever. Now we've switched over again, and David is telling this to his son Shlomo because I don't even think David fully realizes what God meant back when the prophecy was given about an eternal kingdom that lasts forever. Remember that Yeshua is David's son, but not through Solomon. This everlasting kingdom is not Solomon. This everlasting kingdom is Yeshua. And David's encouraging his son Solomon here, and that's great, but I think that even David is not totally getting the whole big picture, which totally understandable. "Now, my son, may Yahweh be with you and prosper you and build the house of Yahweh your Elohim as he has spoken concerning you. May Yahweh give you discretion and understanding and put you in charge of Israel so that you may guard the Torah of Yahweh your Elohim." Oh, famous last words. If only Solomon had done that. If only he had guarded the Torah of Yahweh his Elohim. "Then you will prosper if you will guard to do the statutes and the judgments which Yahweh gave Moshe concerning Israel. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid and do not be dismayed. Now behold, in my affliction I have prepared for the house of Yahweh 100,000 talents of gold, 1,000,000 talents of silver, and copper and iron without weight. It is in abundance. I prepared timber and stone. There are workmen with you in abundance, cutters, workers of stone and timber, and all kinds of men who are skillful in every kind of work. Arise and be doing, and may Yahweh be with you." I think that we will end there for today, and I'll send you away with a question or a series of questions for the parents in here today. Obviously, it was in David's heart to set the stage for Solomon so that he would be as successful as he could possibly be in his reign. And how could you blame him for that? How could you blame David for that in the intention of his heart? But I ask these questions to all of us parents. One, what do we spend our time doing as we raise our kids? Could David have spent more time showing Solomon how to follow God's statutes, how to know them, how to follow them? Could have more time been spent in that? Number two, how much do we prepare for them, our kids? How much do we provide for them? How much do we defend and we fight for them? And three, how much do we protect them and minimize the natural consequences that they might experience? Is any of those things wrong to do? And yet, I think from our own personal experience, and as we're going to learn through the rest of Chronicles, can we go overboard in that? And can we create an environment where our kids grow up so cared for that they never have to trust Yahweh on their own for anything. Because we have prepared the ground so excellently for their lives. That's just something that I, you know, regret sometimes and also wonder about, you know? Where is that balance? So anyway, we'll end there.